Good evening. President Trump addresses the NRA. A report slams New York's mass gang arrests, and an immigration activist gets a First Amendment reprieve. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, April 26, 2019. Speaking to the National Rifle Association for the third straight year, President Donald Trump declared himself a champion for the Second Amendment. Trump said he would be revoking the United States' status as a signatory of the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, which regulates international trade in conventional weapons, from small arms to battle tanks, combat aircraft, and warships. It has long been opposed by the NRA. President Barack Obama signed the pact in 2013, but it has never been ratified by U.S. lawmakers.
So in the last administration, President Obama signed the UN Arms Trade Treaty. And in his waning days in office, he sent the treaty to the Senate to begin the ratification process. This treaty threatened your subjugate, and you know exactly what's going on here, your rights. And your constitutional and international rules and restrictions and regulations. Under my administration, we will never surrender American sovereignty to anyone. We will never allow foreign bureaucrats to trample on your Second Amendment freedom. And that is why my administration will never ratify the UN Arms Trade Treaty. I hope you're happy. I'm impressed. I didn't think too many of you would really know what it is. You know what it is? A big factor. But I see a couple of very happy faces from the NRA over there. And I am officially announcing today that the United States will be revoking the effect of America's signature from this badly misguided treatment. We're taking our signature back. The United Nations will soon receive a formal notice that America is rejecting this treaty. As part of this decision, I will sign right now, in front of a lot of witnesses, a message asking the Senate to discontinue the treaty ratification process and to return the now rejected treaty right back to me in the Oval Office, where I will dispose of it.
Trump's move against the treaty came as he tries to excite an organization pivotal to his victory in 2016, but 3 years later, the NRA is limping towards the next election, divided and diminished. So playing to his base, he's trying to fire them up.
Far-left radicals in Congress want to take away your voice, your jobs, your rights, and they especially want to take away your guns. You know that. They want to take away your guns. You better get out there and vote. You better get out there and vote. It seems like it's a long ways away. It's not.
Gun rights advocates say Trump already delivered in an area where many of them say it matters most, adding pro-gun justices to the United States Supreme Court. Kathy Marino Thomas is an activist for gun violence protection laws. She's also co-host of Gays Against Guns, heard on WBAI every Tuesday after the evening news. She says even NRA members are catching on to Trump's rhetoric.
The gun violence protection groups are working really hard to bring this issue to the forefront and explain to people who may not think about gun violence just how out of control it's gotten. Their financials are down. Their membership is down. I think that they've gone to the radical right, and their members are starting to catch on. It all makes me very happy.
Tell me what the situation is with guns. I live in New York City, so my interaction with guns are much less than the average American. America
New York
today?
State happens to be extremely good on gun violence protection laws. They recently passed a whole series of really proactive laws to protect the citizens of New York State, which is great. Unfortunately, it's not like that in the rest of the country. There's a bill making its way through our Congress that would allow reciprocity of the lowest grade gun laws in the country, meaning that if your state allowed concealed carry with no permit, it would be allowed in Times Square. This is a very dangerous premise. I would really be nervous if I were you living in New York that any of these laws could pass. If they pass at a federal level, the state level law won't protect you.
What are gun violence protection laws and what do they do?
Gun violence protection laws do a couple of things. They increase the amount of days for a background check. They tighten up the laws around background check, making it illegal to have a personal sale of a gun from one person to another without a background check. They extend it from 72 hours, which, by the way, if no results come back on a background check in 72 hours, the answer is yes, not no. You would think the answer would be no, you can't have the permit or the gun. But no, that's not the answer. The answer is yes, if nothing comes back. So that would change that. It would extend, in some places in the country, the law would extend from 72 hours to 3 days, some to 10 days. I would look for a federal 10-day law. Things of that nature, not to take away the guns of a sensible gun owner who abides by the law and applies for a permit and buys their gun in a legal gun sale, but to help people with domestic abuse allegations, for example, from killing their partner in a moment of fury by keeping that gun away from those people, things of that nature.
What do you say to the president's comments? I just heard a bit of them, but the president's comments were basically they're coming to take away your guns. They're coming to take away everything. The radicals.
You know, in general, he's an inflammatory individual. Anyone that listens to him has to take that with a grain of salt and bring it way down. You know, he's the biggest, he's the best, he's a fool. And I think that his comments prove that. Most of these NRA members are beginning to catch on. They read the law, they read the bills that are forthcoming, and they see that it is meant to tighten up sensible gun legislation, not take the guns from anyone. So I'm hoping that the people that were in the room looked at him as the buffoon that I look at him to be.
If you were giving the speech in front of that committee today, in front of that convention today, what would you say?
I would say to them, there is an epidemic of gun violence in our country. It is a completely separate thing from the sensible individual who has an affinity for guns. There is no boogeyman coming to take your gun away, break your door down, and that sort of thing. What needs to happen is we need to pay attention to the epidemic. Children are dying in schools. Arming teachers are not the answer. We need to look at the rest of the world and see what's been done around sensible gun ownership. It works. And I think that with their help, it would really be something in this country. We could solve an epidemic. I would speak to them in that vein.
Kathy Marino Thomas is an activist for gun violence protection laws. She's also co-host of Gays Against Guns, heard on WBAI every Tuesday after the evening news. In more national news, with a quivering voice, Maria Butina begged for leniency Friday as she awaited sentencing on charges of being a secret agent for Russia. She cast herself as an innocent caught up in a massive geopolitical power game. But a federal judge gave her 18 months in prison. She's already served 9 months, followed by deportation to Russia. Last year, Butina admitted to covertly gathering intelligence on the National Rifle Association and other groups at the direction of a former Russian lawmaker. Britain and Ireland made a new push Friday to restore Northern Ireland's collapsed government, responding to public outrage at the killing of a journalist by a banned militant group. Northern Ireland's 1.8 million people have been without a functioning administration since the power-sharing government collapsed in January 2017 over a botched green energy project. The rift soon became widened to broader cultural and political issues separating Northern Ireland's British Unionists and Irish Nationalists. And the United Methodist Church's Judicial Council on Friday upheld major portions of a new plan that strengthens bans on same-sex marriage and ordination of LGBT pastors. Conservatives welcomed the decision and said key elements of the policy, called the traditional plan, could begin taking effect in January. Among liberal and centrist opponents of the plan, there was dismay. One group, Reconciling Ministries Network, called for an upsurge of resistance. The United Methodist Church claims about 12.6 million members worldwide, including nearly 7 million in the United States. It's the largest mainline Protestant denomination in the U.S. While other mainline denominations have embraced gay-friendly practices, the UMC still bans them, though acts of defiance by pro-LGBT clergy members have multiplied. Many have officiated same-sex weddings. Others have come out from the pulpit. The traditional plan aspires to beef up discipline against those engaged in defiance. The Reconciling Ministries Network, which supports LGBT inclusion, call its supporters to repeatedly state your dissent, adding, "We'll call upon the church to repent of the sin of homophobia. Now is the time to rise and resist." U.S. border authorities say they've started to increase the biometric data they take from children 13 years old and younger, including fingerprints. This is despite privacy concerns and government policy intended to restrict what can be collected from migrant youths. And the Pentagon says it may send about 300 more support troops and lawyers to the U.S.-Mexico border in roles that could put them in contact with migrants. And in New York City criminal justice news, it was 3 years ago this week that hundreds of federal police, backed by helicopters, armored vehicles, and NYPD SWAT teams, swarmed the Eastchester Gardens houses along White Plains Road in the Bronx as part of a gang crackdown that followed the death of a young woman in a reputed gang assault. 120 people, mostly black and Latino men, were prosecuted, led by then U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. He said the arrested people were members of two rival street gangs that wreaked havoc in the neighborhood for years. William Bratton, then NYPD commissioner, said gang members do not belong on our streets. He added they're going to go where they belong, federal prison. A new report about the gang arrests reveals troubling details about the prosecution and raises questions of due process and the abuse of federal anti-conspiracy powers like the RICO, or Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Law. A CUNY law professor who co-authored the report is Babe Howell. She says of the 120 arrested in the gang raid, two-thirds had either minor or no criminal records. Only 22 of the arrested were convicted on gun charges. Most got no or little jail time. But some lost jobs and spent time in jail despite their innocence. The police raids were captured on security cameras showing armed teams of uniformed men breaking down doors, terrifying children, and forcing occupants onto their hands and knees.
3 years ago, in the very early morning hours, 700 NYPD, FBI, I'm sorry, I don't think FBI was there, Homeland Security, DEA, ATF, raided homes in the Bronx and Eastchester Gardens and an area along White Plains Road on the claim that two neighborhood crews, were wreaking havoc in that area for 9 years. And those 120 were rounded up, taken to court. Some of them were already in prison and already serving time for in connection with the same conduct that they were charging in this case. And the case itself was a RICO conspiracy and narcotics conspiracy case, with also a charge of possession of firearms in connection with the RICO conspiracy or the narcotics conspiracy. One thing that was lost on me and probably would have been lost on the public, given the announcement that the crews were responsible for murders, attempted murder, slashings, robbery, was that those were not the charges in the indictment.
What is RICO? What is a RICO indictment?
So RICO is the Racketeering
Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act.
Yes, Corrupt Organizations Act. I always forget the I. And it is designed, it was passed by the federal legislation for attacking organized crime. Specifically at the time it was meant for the mafia, but also the kind of white-collar crime and other highly sophisticated crimes that have big effects on interstate commerce that really affect the legitimate economy and put all Americans at risk. It's been kind of militarized to use against regular street crime, but that should essentially be a state case.
What's behind this whole event?
What they would say is we are focusing on hotspots, yes, that there are crews, that there are rivalries. But the reality is that the rivalries and crews have no official organization. That crews these days are not organized with a hierarchy. There's no orders. That if there's violence, it's usually individual conduct. And the crews themselves are peer groups who are friends. They often make music together and hang out. But one is not kind of responsible or involved with the conduct of the others. And the outcomes of these cases, the sentences, many of which were time served or less than 2 or 3 years, most of which had nothing to do with possession of firearm or harming anyone, kind of confirmed that there's this overbreadth. There's this big narrative of rival conspiracies, and there's some rival gangs fighting. There's some truth to that. But it's really a matter of individuals having individual beefs with each other. It's also an issue that should be taken care of in state court. These are not criminal enterprises as required by RICO. They are informal groups with very little effect on commerce at all.
What effect did this have on the communities?
The communities have been impacted in enormous ways. I mean, you start out with the families. You have these militarized raids and families being woken with their doors broken down at gunpoint, ordered out of their home. And in many cases, you know, months or years after someone's been involved with the crew, and in many cases, people who have no criminal history. So it's a shocking and devastating kind of way to do policing. Even if you want to arrest these folks, you can simply wait outside their homes or arrest without the no-knock warrants and the helicopters. It's trauma in the moment and then tremendous destruction of community, because the way they build these cases is your social media, you like this, you were in photos with that one, you grew up with the other, and all the kind of friendship ties are actually what's being used to show these people are a group, they're associated with each other. So ability to post to social media, like things that your friends are into, even kind of pose as young people do in terms of being tough, that's all fodder for these massive indictments. Of the 120, there were 115 felony convictions, and many of them, over 30, were for supposedly selling marijuana in furtherance of either the RICO conspiracy or as part of the narcotics distribution. So people who were selling nickel bags, which would be a misdemeanor at most, and often who had already done a day or two of community service or been processed through the state courts, were getting felony convictions and years of supervision in the federal system. There was one defendant who went to trial on a very weak murder case. He was sentenced to life plus 55 for allegedly aiding and abetting the actual killer, who got a sentence of about 25 years, if I recall correctly, about half of what he got. Unfortunately, conspiracy and RICO charges have always been known as the darling of the prosecution's nursery. It's very, very difficult to beat them. There's very little that needs to be proven. But as a matter of justice, if we care about racial profiling, we have to look beyond the label gang, and we have to look beyond the label of precision or predictive policing and see what's going on behind this, because it's, once again, an overbroad criminalization, the kind that we've rejected in broken windows and stop and frisk policing. As in those cases, we have to organize as a community, first investigate what's going on, and meanwhile, ideally, though, stop it.
Babe Howell is a CUNY law professor and co-author of the report, The Bronx 120 Mass Gang Prosecution. Responding to the report today, Mayor Bill de Blasio defended the gang arrests. He says the takedowns have made communities safer. In more New York City news, a federal appeals court has found ICE may have violated immigrant activist Ravi Ragbir's First Amendment rights when it tried to deport him last year. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan said Ragbir's advocacy on immigration reform is core political speech and that it's plausible ICE tried to deport him in retaliation for organizing protests against the agency. The court ruled that District Court Judge Kevin Castle made a mistake last year when he found that he didn't have jurisdiction to intervene. It ordered him to determine whether Ragbir's First Amendment rights were in fact violated. The lower court has also ordered to issue a temporary injunction barring the government from removing Ragbir in the meantime. Ragbir's attorneys say the director of ICE's New York City field office, Scott Michkowski, complained that Ragbir's protests in 2017 were leading to negative press about ICE. The complaints were made just days before Ragbir's arrest by ICE in January 2018 at what was supposed to be a routine check-in. Ragbir spoke with WBAI on Friday. He says the judge's decision will help other activists in the non-citizen community who were similarly targeted for their advocacy.
So the judge ruled a number of things. One is that there is a semi-removal from ICE retaliation, not only at the Second Circuit, but until it gets to the district level, there's still that pending stay. The other thing that it has, that the judges ruled, is that there is a violation of my First Amendment, and the court does have jurisdiction to act on that.
How do they say your First Amendment rights were violated?
Because of the speeches and the interaction that I had elected officials go in with me to Federal Plaza while I was reporting to immigration. And it is not speculation. It was specific examples that the ICE officers used, and this is what brought to light, and the court used those examples to show that this wasn't just a process that of deportation, but it was retaliation itself.
How did they find out, or where did this evidence come from?
There were many of our members who were, including faith leaders. So the faith leaders had met with the directors of ICE to continue to talk about my case. And during that interview, there was these comments made by the ICE officer. Very specific examples of them quoting speeches and presentations had made about the injustices that I had faced and that ICE continually imposes upon the community of non-citizens.
So what does this mean as far as your case?
On the first level, which is me personally, it makes me feel a certain amount of peace of mind. It was good to know that there was a stay that was still pending, that was still available, and that ICE could not come looking for me. Without that stay, we all know that ICE would have been at my door waiting to take me away. We were all talking about what would happen and if this happens, what my attorneys would have to do. So this, basically for myself, my wife, my attorneys, my friends, everyone is breathing a sigh of relief. But in addition to that, if the scope of the decision is much larger and it affects not only myself as an activist leader, but there are other activist leaders throughout the countries who have been targeted by ICE and retaliation for the speeches. So you have a number of examples of Maru Mora Villalpando, and you have Alejandra Paulos, you have 21 Savage, the rapper. You also have Carlos Rojas, who were targeted because of the speeches. And now there is a way for them to address these retaliation in court because of this decision. So it's a great decision for the larger community, and we are all excited about this and the impact it will have.
Anything you'd like to add?
We will need citizens also to stand with us and to speak with us and for us during this process, because we know that this administration is targeting our communities. It's about ethnic cleansing, and that they want to remove people of color because there is a white nationalist president and his supporters are supremacists and racists. And everyone needs to stand up against culture like this. Otherwise, our society is going to dissolve and become something that we don't want.
Ragbir, a native of Trinidad and Tobago, was a green card holder until he was convicted in 2001 for wire fraud in New Jersey and served 30 months in prison. Afterwards, the government granted him four different stays of removal with supervisory check-ins because he was not considered a high priority for deportation. And hours after a mass escape from an immigration detention center in southern Mexico, throngs of detained migrants raised their fists in the air Friday and chanted, "We want food, we want out." It was the largest mass escape from a Mexican immigration center in memory and the latest example of how the government has become overloaded by a flood of Central American, Cuban, and Haitian immigrants. Residents of Tapachula, a city on Mexico's southern border with Guatemala, reported seeing hundreds of migrants running through the streets late Thursday, some only half-dressed, some cramming themselves into passing minivans to escape. Unarmed immigration agents were simply unable to stop the migrants from fleeing, according to federal authorities. And finally, the universe is expanding faster than it used to, meaning it's about a billion years younger than we thought, a new study by a Nobel Prize winner says. And that's sending a shudder through the world of physics, making astronomers rethink some of its most basic concepts. At issue is a number called the Hubble constant, a calculation for how fast the universe is expanding. Some scientists call it the most important number in cosmology, the study of the origin and development of the universe. Using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope, Johns Hopkins University astronomer Adam Riess concluded in this week's Astrophysical Journal that the figure is 9% higher than the previous calculation, which is based on studying leftovers from the Big Bang. The trouble is, Riess and others think both calculations are correct. Confused? That's okay. So are the experts. It's looking more and more like we're going to need something new to explain this, said Riess, who won the 2011 Nobel in Physics. NASA astrophysicist John Mather, another Nobel winner, said this leaves two obvious options. One, we're making mistakes we can't find yet. Two, nature is something we can't find yet. And that's some of the news for Friday, April 26, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.